say, look, you know, I would love to find a Bigfoot. I would love to be the first person to prove that ghosts exist, or find a chupacabra, prove that near-death experience, all these sorts of things. I don't have any axe to grind. My axe to grind is, what is the truth? That's my interest. I'm going to sleep fine tonight whether people believe that, you know, that this guy Alex Malarkey went to heaven or not.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, making up crap about dying and seeing Jesus. 16 years investigating the paranormal and finding nothing paranormal. And bad clowns. All coming up on this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I will be your host for this week's episode. You know, there are a lot of cool jobs in the world. For example, a Hollywood actor, a secret agent, a male prostitute. But you know, there's one job that I always thought was probably up there on that list as one of the coolest ever. And that's got to be a paranormal investigator. How cool would that be? And we get to talk to an honest-to-goodness, real, scientific paranormal investigator right here on today's show. We're going to be speaking with Benjamin Radford. And the chances are that you probably have seen this gentleman on one of many TV shows, flipping through the channels on the Discovery Channel when they're looking in the lake for the Loch Ness Monster. They always bring on that token skeptic. The person who tries to inject a little bit of reason and critical thinking into the whole process that most people just kind of tend to ignore because, of course, they want the magic. But here we are going to talk about the reason. We're going to talk about what actually goes on in these paranormal investigations. So it's time to cue the appropriate music and bring on our guest. I have the great pleasure of speaking with Mr. Benjamin Radford. How you doing?
Doing good.
Great. Thanks for being on with us. I'm very excited to talk about scientific paranormal investigation. Always an interesting topic. I'm sure you know you devoted, 16 years of your life to this?
Yeah, something like that. You know, I've been a research fellow at the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, or CFI or CSI, PsyCop, whatever they're calling themselves these days, for many years. I'm the deputy editor of Skeptical Inquiry Science Magazine, and I also do articles and columns for Discovery News and elsewhere. And so it's I sometimes sort of get pigeonholed as, you know, the Bigfoot guy or the Chupacabra guy or, you know, whatever else. Right. And that's fine. I mean, I've sort of resigned myself to that. But in fact, you know, I sort of see what I do in a broader context in terms of it being sort of a particularly sensational flavor of science literacy and media literacy and things like that.
Okay, before we get into some of this really interesting scientific paranormal stuff, I want to talk about this boy who a while ago claimed that he died and went to heaven and was brought to heaven by these angels. And just recently, he recanted this story, saying, I just made the whole thing up. I just wanted some attention. And you wrote an article about that. What's that about?
I did, yeah. It actually made the news, sort of hit a little bit at the end of last week, and I wrote a piece about it over the weekend, and it's on Discovery News this morning on January 20th. And it's interesting because it's fascinating when you look at the context. There's about a dozen or so books that I've got many of them on my shelf that are supposedly true firsthand accounts of meeting heaven and going to hell, and they have titles like The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven, and Heaven Is for Real, and there's a whole interesting subgenre of these, and they're typically Christian books, and written for a Christian audience, and of course they feed into they draw upon and feed from the Christian theology, and people love these even if you're not a Christian, if you're sort of more of an atheist or agnostic or New Ager. It provides allegedly, you know, true stories, you know, ultimately, of course, they're anecdotes, but it's, you know, people who claim to have, you know, met Jesus and met God and all these sorts of things. And so there's a whole fascinating subgenre of these books. And it's actually interesting because, if you look at people's accounts of heaven, they actually vary quite a bit. It's for example, convicted felon Sylvia Brown, who died recently, a year or two back. She wrote at least two books talking about heaven through her spirit guide. And so she sort of gives sort of generally bland, you know, like heaven is good. You know, it's like, yeah. Oh yeah, good things happen, right? As opposed to, you know, heaven sucks, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting if you start looking at if you get past the nitty gritty, in important details, different people's supposed true stories about heaven and the information about those actually vary on significant details, which makes you wonder, like, hold on here. Are we talking about two different versions of heaven, or, you know, do each of us have an individual heaven? But anyway, the most recent case was it was about a guy named Alex Malarkey, a young boy, and his father, Kevin, who in 2004 were injured in a car accident. And Alex was paralyzed, and in his 2010 book, The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven, co-written with his father, of course, because he's you know, was very young and of course badly injured. He talked about visiting heaven and seeing God and angels and this sort of thing, and he was in a coma for 2 months, and when he returned, he had this whole story. And it turns out last week this guy Alex contacted the publishers and others and said, "Look, you know, I made it up. This wasn't true." I'll read a little bit of a statement. He says, "Please forgive the brevity, but because of my limitations, limitations mean physical and mental, because of his injuries, I have to keep this short. I did not die. I did not go to heaven. I said I went to heaven because I thought it would get me attention. When I made the claims that I did, I had never read the Bible. People have profited from lies and continue to. And they should read the Bible, which is enough. The Bible is the only source of truth. Anything written by man cannot be infallible." So it's interesting. You know, he's clearly sincere. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I don't think it's a lie covering up a lie. I mean, I think he genuinely, you know, he's coming clean and said, "Look, you know, This best-selling book that has my name on it and that's supposedly my true story never really happened." And frankly, I mean, it's easy to make fun of this guy, particularly since his last name is Malarkey.
Right.
But you know, it's easy to sort of call him a little liar and this and that. But in fact, you know, in my piece, I give him credit because, you know, it's not easy to come forward and admit that you were wrong and that you lied, especially, you know, in such an emotionally charged subject as this, you know, where you're essentially betraying many Christians who bought into your story and bought your book and this and that. And of course, it would have been very easy for him to just keep his mouth shut and no one would have known the difference. So, you know, I don't join in the chorus of people admonishing him. I think that it took some courage for him to come forward with that.
Yeah, I would think that the people who are admonishing him are not atheists, because, you know, we never believed that this actually happened anyway, but rather the Christians who now have their credibility or the credibility of their group damaged because of the false testimony of this boy.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it's fascinating. You look at, I mean, there's a whole, you know, very strong history of what's called pious fraud, where people will, in service of a larger truth, essentially perpetuate lies. One of the most famous ones that I can think of off the top of my head was a book by Lauren Stratford, and you may know some of the story. But she claimed that she was part of a satanic cult, and this was during the big satanic panic hysteria in the 1980s, when Geraldo Rivera was. But between his opening Al Capone's vault and finding dusty beer bottles, he was busy whipping up fear and concern across the country about satanic cults and the evil things that they were doing.
Right.
And this woman, Stratford, wrote a book called Satan's Underground, in which she had these horrific stories of this abuse and killing children and raping and just all sorts of horrible stuff. And of course, in the end, it turned, you know, she found God and this and that. And the whole thing turned out to be false. In fact, it's interesting because it was actually a Christian publisher that researched her claims. And it was actually Christians who stood up and said, "Look, you know, there's some dubious things here," and they eventually exposed her. But I find that subject fascinating, where you have somebody who tells a true life story, a true life story for the greater good. Like, oh, this is, it's helping people come to God. It's reinforcing their beliefs, and it turns out not to be true.
Yeah. Pious fraud is very interesting because if you put yourself in the shoes of a believer, and I'm not just talking about, somebody who goes to church, I'm talking about a true believer, somebody who really believes that if you do not accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you are spending eternity in hell. Think about what you wouldn't do for mankind. Think about, all these stupid little lies that you could tell and all these stories and, I met Jesus. And I mean, personally, I would say anything if I really believe that I'm saving somebody's eternal soul, then there really isn't much limit to what I wouldn't say or probably do, which is scary, of course, too, because, some people do some crazy things in the name of these superstitions.
Absolutely. And that's one thing I find fascinating. There was another similar case. It's escaping my mind, but there was a case about 10 years ago of a woman who wrote a book about honor killings. There was actually a documentary. I'm blanking on it at the moment, but a woman, she wrote this very passionate book about this friend of hers who had been killed in honor killings in the Middle East. And it turned out to be not true at all. And of course, she there was a documentary made about it talking about, the sort of how her whole story unraveled. But it's again, it's, you see people who they truly believe in the greater good. I mean, these are sincere, genuine people who think that, telling a couple lies and spinning tales, as long as it sort of improves them along the way, of course, and makes them out to be the victim and the hero. And also, look, they figure, what does it matter, right? You tell a story, and if it brings more people to God or if it makes people act better, then the ends justify the means.
Yeah. And they are playing a risky game, though, because as we've just seen and demonstrated, if you get caught in the lie, then that does a lot more damage to bringing people towards God, to your cause, than if you didn't tell the lie in the first place. So there's definitely pros and cons to this game.
Well, it's interesting. The to my mind, the model of skepticism in this sort of against this sort of pious fraud are people like the Anti-Defamation League. The custodian, the people who deal with the Holocaust and things like that, they have been very, very proactive about trying to weed out false Holocaust memoirs. And there's been three or four that I can think of. And so I find it really fascinating because, over the years and over the decades, various people have had memoirs of, I survived the Holocaust. There was one woman who wrote a book about how she was, it was a Holocaust story, but she was also kind of raised by wolves. There was this sort of, she ran from the Nazis and then she was raised by, and this whole thing.
Did she happen to be on the Titanic too when it's like?
You have to wonder right about it.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Benjamin Radford, author of the book Scientific Paranormal Investigation, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries.
The Jewish groups that are dedicated to preserving the true and accurate history of the Holocaust, they are on the front lines of trying to vet these sorts of things and trying to make sure that bogus information and stories and anecdotes and memoirs don't make it into the Holocaust literature, because they understand very, very clearly that's the sort of thing that will undermine them. And I don't see that same sort of mechanism, organization or social mechanism that's vetting these other stories. I think about the recent scandal published in Rolling Stone magazine about the gang rape at a fraternity at the University of Virginia. That story went all over the place, and it wasn't until the Washington Post began sort of re-reporting the story that it began falling apart. But there's not a natural other side to the story, a natural skeptic to many of these sorts of stories to raise the red flags earlier on.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's the confirmation bias at work, essentially. Everybody who wants that story to be true will just accept it and won't look for disconfirming information on that story, which is unfortunate because those people are the people that should attack that story and say, or at least look at it and look at the facts in order to make sure that they're not perpetuating a lie. What's interesting when we're talking about this, I'm thinking of the Catholic Church. And as you probably know, they had the devil's advocate. They were the ones who came up with this whole idea. When somebody wants to say, make somebody a saint, they actually put the miracles to test. And they bring in this devil's advocate who will be the skeptic of the group to see if that, if, well, they can't really see if a miracle really occurred or not. But what they do is they say, okay, well, there's no way we could explain this naturally, which means it's either a miracle or just simply unknown. But if they just put it in the unknown category, then they're good enough as writing it off as a miracle.
Right. Just to wrap up the malarkey story. So, and take that as you will, you know, it's interesting in the piece that I wrote for Discovery talking, what I was curious about and what I looked at was, you know, we're talking about confirmation bias is, you know, why is it that, that Alex Malarkey's story co-written with his father was so widely accepted? And part of the reason you touched on before is confirmation bias. You know, his narrative fit very clearly and very closely to what Christians wanted to believe about heaven. If he had said, I went to heaven and, you know, it was a great time, there were flying elephants and they were singing Britney Spears songs and I did heroin.
Right.
That could totally be true. I don't know. I haven't been to heaven. You haven't been to heaven. So, you know, for all we know, that could literally be what heaven is like. But if he had come back and said that, then, of course, it would be immediately dismissed out of hand as being the product of a hallucination or a prank or a hoax by people for whom his vision of heaven didn't fit their preconceived notions. And so this is why you have to be especially skeptical of stories that fit a popular script or narrative. Because when you believe that X is true, and someone offers you their first person account, whether it's independently corroborable or not, you're like, okay, yeah, I believe that. That fits what I want to believe about heaven. That fits what I believe about, you know, the world or society, whatever else. And so you tend to give those sorts of stories a free pass instead of you know, applying some skepticism to them.
All right, very good. Well, let's move on and talk about scientific paranormal investigation. What we were talking about earlier had to do with this whole idea of heaven and investigating these claims that seems to me like there's no way we could ever possibly establish that there is a heaven. We could only corroborate these stories, if you will, and see those as evidence pointing in the right direction. So how exactly do you look at something like this and investigate it from a scientific perspective, given that the basis of science is methodological naturalism, that is, testing claims within the natural universe?
Sure. You know, when you have these different stories of people who have claimed to have had, you know, first person true accounts of going to heaven and you know, meeting God and angels and this and that, you know, there's no independent way to confirm that. I mean, I can't, you know, unless I go to heaven and, you know, take photographs and poke around, it's unprovable.
Right.
But what you can do is you can take sort of basically a forensic literary analysis, and you can compare their narratives, and you can say, okay, you've got a dozen people who each claim to have had these experiences in heaven. And you can look at their similarities of their narratives, you know. In what ways are they similar? Obviously, if they share the same theological background, then there are going to be some similarities there in terms of, you know, finding, you know, missing relatives and who love you and these sorts of things. But what could be really interesting is sort of looking at the details where they differ. You know, like, okay, well, why is it this one person went to heaven and, you know, and saw cars driving by? Another person went to heaven and said that it's all a bunch of wispy, you know, life forces up in the clouds. You know, which one of these is true, if either one of them? So that's one angle you can take on it.
Right. Well, maybe they just went to a different part of heaven. Like if somebody goes to South Central LA and somebody goes to Vermont, you know, it's different.
Yeah.
You never know. What's interesting, as you pointed out, is this idea of the shared narrative, which is very common, and it's common in alien abductions as well, as you probably know. There's this cultural idea of the alien with the big head, the rounded head, and the huge eyes, and the skinny body, and the long, spindly fingers. Do you think that that plays a large part, not only in these heaven stories, but in a lot of these stories, like the Bigfoot stories, the Loch Ness Monster? Because everybody kind of knows what they should be seeing.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And that's actually a part of skeptical inquiry and skepticism that I think has been neglected largely in the past few decades is looking at how pop culture and the mass media inform people's opinions about these about these subjects. So again, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, you know, ghosts, afterlife, things like that. And particularly, I think, and I've been meaning to write an article about this for, I don't know, 20 years now, may or may not get around to it, but Steven Spielberg has been enormously influential in people's ideas about the paranormal. Everything from, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark had you know, paranormal themes in it.
Poltergeist.
You know, there's all, you know, I think it was part of the movie Poltergeist.
Right.
I don't know if he was a producer on that, but you know, it's fascinating when you look at where do people get these ideas, and it's especially interesting to me if you look at notions of demonic possession and exorcism. You can very clearly trace back people's ideas about what happens in an exorcism to William Peter Blatty's 1973 novel and William Friedkin's 74 around there film. Mm-hmm. I think it was 74 or 76, The Exorcist. It's crystal clear that people have taken their notions of what an exorcism is from those sorts of things. And in fact, there's actually an even further fold of The Amityville Horror, which was written by Jay Anson. And it was a novel and then turned into sort of another supposedly true story,
right,
of a demonic house. Jay Anson's novel, The Amityville Horror, was clearly influenced by Blatty's novel, The Exorcist, and then it sort of goes back from there. But these were very seminal, very influential films. And because look at it this way, you know, most people have not had first personal encounters with demonically possessed people, even allegedly demonic possessed people. Most people have not had encounters, you know, with ghosts or Bigfoot or what have you. And so where do they draw what they think that experience is like? Well, they draw it from films, from books, from things like that. And so, you know, that doesn't mean that their narrative is necessarily incorrect. I mean, for all we know, you know, ghosts could look exactly like they do in movies.
Right.
But it does highlight the importance and the influence of these sorts of films in pop culture.
Yeah, well, it's all about probability and critical thinking. If there is that causal question, but I think you addressed that very well. Like, being skeptical, we would ask the question, well, maybe it's the culture that's influencing these ideas of the aliens and heaven and all that stuff. But we would also have to ask, well, maybe it's people's visions that actually influenced the culture.
Right.
But as you pointed out, we could actually trace this stuff back to Hollywood and to written accounts, science fiction accounts, and start from there, and we could see how these things evolved. And yeah, sure, maybe that they're coincidentally it happens to match what real aliens look like or real heaven, but it's not right. That likely. And that's kind of what we do in science. It's about probabilities. It's not about what's definitely heaven or not.
Absolutely. And so I think it's I think it's instructive for people to sort of take a step back, you know, whether you believe in these things or not. I mean, I you know, whatever your belief system is that take a few minutes to think, okay, you know, why do I believe that ghosts are that way? Why do I believe that Bigfoot is that way? Why, you know, how would I know if there was truly a ghost in my house? Is what am I comparing that to? For all we know, a ghost in the house could look exactly like ordinary, you know, the refrigerator coming on. For all we know, that could be a ghost, right? I mean, so you know, again, this sort of gets back to taking a step back and saying, okay, where are these narratives coming from, and how are they informing my opinion of the world? And particularly the unexplained parts, the parts that supposedly science can't touch or can't verify.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's this British neurologist named Oliver Sacks who wrote this book back in 2012 called Hallucinations. And he talked about the hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, which is basically when you're falling asleep, you start to have these hallucinations. And these are very common. It's not, yes. You don't have to be ill. You don't have to be mentally unstable. It's just when you're falling asleep and when you're waking up, your prefrontal cortex, the part that does the reasoning and the logic, that actually falls asleep, but your other brain is alive and awake. And you start, I mean, you really see these things. And I think I talked about it on the show before. I've had some wild ones before. But a lot of this stuff actually comes from what's going on in the culture and what movies you've seen and what you're aware of. That's how these visions are formed. It's more of a like a top-down approach as opposed to coming from like some crazy spiritual world and making their way into your brain. No, it doesn't work that way. And his book is very good at explaining this whole phenomenon. And I think anybody who's ever saw Jesus at their bedside or saw an alien at their bedside and couldn't move, after reading this book, they would fully understand, say, ah, that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. Sacks' work is really interesting. We had an interview with Sacks by Indra Viscontis about, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, and he sort of talked about some of that. And it's fascinating. And another aspect of this is that it also partly explains the illusion of correlation. That is, you often hear, or at least I often hear, because I do this all the time, people claiming like, well, you know, the fact that these experiences they're reporting are so similar is proof that they exist. People right. say, well, whether it's alien abductions or meeting Jesus or whatever else, they say, look, you have, you know, a middle-aged housewife in Topeka, and you have a 17-year-old kid in Japan, and they both reported similar experiences. How is that possible unless it's real? Hmm. Well, the answer is that if they're drawing from the same cultural scripts, if they're being influenced by the same sorts of mass media depictions of these things, then of course they're going to be similar. In fact, you would expect them to be similar. Yet this sorts of thing, whether it's near-death experience, Bigfoot, what have you, this is often offered as some sort of like definitive proof. Well, clearly these people didn't collaborate. Well, of course they didn't collaborate. They just happened to, they watch movies, they watch TV, they have some idea of what a ghost is supposed to look like or near-death experience is supposed to be like, and so that informs their experience.
Yeah. Another common objection I hear a lot to skepticism in this area is the idea that, okay, look at how many people are making these paranormal claims. I mean, there are literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of them that you could find on the internet and books, wherever. Even if just 0.001% of them are true, this shows that paranormal forces actually act in this world. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, that's I've heard that over and over again. I wrote a piece about 10 years ago called Bigfoot at 50, a half century of Bigfoot research. And in the last section of that article, I talk about this. And basically the argument is that where there's smoke, there's fire. The argument is that you know, there's all these people are saying all these things, there must be some truth to it. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's simply not the case. Just because 20 or 200 or 2,000 people claim that they saw something weird or mysterious doesn't mean that there's actually a Bigfoot out there. It's the example that I use is that, you know, you can't combine 20 cups of weak coffee into strong coffee. It's the level of evidence that you need to have it be acceptable to scientists. And so the simple fact is that that argument is based upon the premise that if enough people say something, it must be true. If enough people misunderstand something, then that misunderstanding must be validated in the real world. And of course, that's not true at all. The fact is that we know from psychological research there's so many factors that go into an experience, particularly a supposedly paranormal unexplained experience. I talk about this in my book, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries. I talk about that in chapter 3, that there's so many potential sources of error from misremembering something, misunderstanding something, miscommunicating something, that you know, the what they're talking about are anecdotes. They're talking about personal experience. And there's nothing wrong with personal experience. You know, I'm having a personal experience right now. So are you. Mm. So is anyone else who's listening to this. But personal experiences are not good evidence. They're not scientific evidence. And so it's basically saying that if a lot of people experience something weird, it must be true. And the correct way to look at it is no. If a lot of different people experience something weird, all that means is they experience something weird. I experience weird things all the time, you know. So just because you don't know what it is doesn't mean it's paranormal, doesn't mean it's unexplained. It just means you don't know what it is, which is fine. But the logical leap that they make in that argument is saying that that not knowing what it is evidence that something unusual or paranormal exists. And of course, that's not true at all.
No, it is not. Another objection that we often hear is that science does not have all the answers. You need to have an open mind to uncover the paranormal mysteries of the universe. How would you respond to that one?
That's absolutely true. Science does not have all the answers. In fact, it's conspicuously the opposite. Many of the people who have these firm beliefs, they believe they do have the answer. If you talk to a person who believes that they went to heaven, they are typically not open to any other alternative interpretations. So if you talk to someone and they'll say, no, I know for a fact I went to heaven, I saw Jesus, this and that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see this all the time. I interview people who I know Bigfoot exists because I saw it. And the problem is that I don't adopt that sort of that position on the other side. I don't say I've never seen Bigfoot, therefore it does not exist, because that's a fallacy. So it's interesting because the people that are so adamant that they have the truth are the believers. Scientists are perfectly willing to admit we don't have all the answers. What we believe about the world, whether the subject is near-death experience, or miracles, or Bigfoot, or ghosts, or anything else, or biology, or space exploration, what have you, that is all subject to revision and change. That's how science works, is that you have a body of research that is established through the scientific processes, and in the end you have these hypotheses and you work from that. And next month or next year, some scientist may find some rock solid provable discovery that undermines all that, and that's fine. So instead of criticizing science because it changes its mind in the face of new evidence, people should recognize that's an important quality. That's not a bug, that's a feature.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Benjamin Radford, author of the book Scientific Paranormal Investigation: How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries. Well, Ben, you've been doing this for 16 years, so I would think that you'd be on the front lines. If anything was actually real that was out there, you'd be one of the guys that would be discovering it. Would you take it to James Randi and collect $1 million?
I would love to. I could use $1 million. Absolutely.
You could even split it with the person who discovered this. And
yeah. I mean, this is the weird part is, in what I do, I get accused of a lot of things. I get accused of being part of Big Pharma. I get accused of anytime I write about UFOs,
right.
I get hate mail from people saying, oh, you're covering up for the Air Force.
Yeah, you're a shill for the government.
Yeah, really? You think that I'm hobnobbing with Air Force officials to debunk your crap? Give me a break, right? But this is the mentality that they have.
Yeah.
And I say, look, I would love to find a Bigfoot. I would love to be the first person to prove that ghosts exist, or find a chupacabra, or prove that near-death experience, all these sorts of things.
Right.
I don't have any axe to grind. My axe to grind is what is the truth,
which is very important. So Ben, in all this time of all of your experimenting and searching and investigating, have you ever come across something that you said, holy crap, there actually might be something here?
I think that in terms of subjects that I've looked into where there might be something to it, I would say the topic that I think might be most likely is intuition. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean intuition in the sense of like ESP or predicting the future, or knowing things that remote viewers, or reading newspapers from across the world in a trance. I'm talking about a sort of a more down-to-earth sense of intuition in the psychology sense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in psychology, you know that you can go into a room and you can get information about the room and about what's going on without knowing that you know that. And so oftentimes in our everyday lives, we will have additional information that we weren't explicitly told about new people. You know, you meet somebody, they come up to you. Just looking at a photograph of them gives you enormous amounts of information about them. It gives you an idea of, you know, their culture, what language might they speak, how they're dressed, their education. You know, there's lots of information. Now, a lot of that might be wrong, but there's visual cues and auditory cues that in which we're conveyed information that's often correct that we don't recognize. And so I think that when people talk about intuition as being, you know, oh, how did I possibly know that? I wasn't told that. Yes, that's true. You weren't told that, but that doesn't mean it's paranormal. That's how psychology works. And so that would be my best guess.
Yeah. Well, that's a great example, because that's a perfect example of where real science can be even more fascinating than pseudoscience or than the mysterious, the unknown, whatever. And yeah, the whole idea of intuition, what's important to realize about that is something that you said, that it is probability-based. Mm-hmm. Intuition, it's not, a lot of people are under the false assumption that they're very intuitive, therefore what they are intuitive about is right, is 100% right. That's not how intuition works. It is probability based. So you're more likely at times going to be right than wrong based on how that intuition was formed. But it's not an exact science, if you want to call it that, if you want to look at it that way. But there is something there. It's amazing the way that the brain works and the unconscious works and how you get information, how you have access to this information without even consciously thinking about it. It is fascinating.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a new book out by Chris French called Anomalistic Psychology. I think I wrote a review of it in the next issue of Skeptical Inquirer magazine. But it's a really good book in terms of if you want to look at, you know, the psychology of anomalistic experiences and paranormal beliefs and that sort of things. I've forgotten his co-author's name. I'm sorry, but Chris Finch from the UK wrote it, and it's really one of the better ones if anyone's interested in seeing that.
All right, cool. I take it that you do a lot of interviews, and not just interviews like this where we're both skeptics, but interviews where you are the token skeptic among a whole bunch of believers in a certain paranormal phenomenon. How do they treat you in these cases? Do you ever shed some light on the issue and get people to say, oh, wow, you know, I didn't even think about that? Or do you see a lot of backfire effect where they just stick their metaphorical head in the sand and say, I'm not budging? How exactly do you see that working?
Yeah, it's interesting. It actually varies somewhat. I've been told on several occasions that after appearing on an otherwise, we'll just call it believer show, that I've had people basically say, you know, I thought you were an asshole, but apparently you're not. And I guess I'd take that as a compliment. But part of it, I think, is that skeptics often have a really bad reputation, whether it's, you know, earned, unearned, you know, whatever else, is that a lot of people assume that if you're a skeptic, that you're dismissive, you're a debunker, you're a denier, you call everybody stupid and crazy. And when they hear my approach, that's not what I do at all. Mm. You know, when I'm talking to believers, when I'm talking to people who had experiences about these things, whether it's ghosts or near-death experience or psychics or miracles, what have you, I treat them respectfully. I really do, because, again, this goes back to having a background in psychology, because I'm well aware of the ways in which our memories and our perceptions can be wrong and can mislead us. And so I don't begin an investigation assuming that anybody's lying to me. I don't begin by assuming that whoever's telling me their experience is stupid or crazy or a liar. I assume that they're probably telling me the truth. And you know, so I'm making a genuine effort to understand what they experienced. Now, they may or may not accept my skeptical explanations at the end of the day, but they often recognize, like, wow, okay, well, you know, he didn't just call me an idiot and walk away. He took the time to hear my story and try to help work it out. And so that's one experience that I've had. I've had people say, okay, well, you know, I don't necessarily you know, buy everything you said in terms of the explanation, but, you know, I do recognize that, you know, you made a good faith effort and, you know, and in fact, this probably is the case. So that's been gratifying. On occasion, you know, I've every now and then you get people who just hate skeptics or hate me for whatever reason. And there's nothing you can do about that. I'm just like, look, dude, you know, if you don't like what I write, then don't read it. No one's forcing you to buy my books. No one's forcing you to read my articles and blogs. You know, if you think I'm wrong, you know, my request is, if you think I'm wrong, then tell me why. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think I screwed something up or I did investigation and I totally blew it or I don't know what I'm talking about, then I respect that. You know, what information are you using? What sources? What are your references? What are you using as your information? Because here's mine. And most of the time, the people who approach me with that, they haven't done any research on their own. It's not like, oh, I've done more research and he's wrong. It's just like, well, you know, I saw something different on TV and he's wrong. I'm like, I this happened to me like last year as I mentioned, I did a book on the Chupacabra. And I wrote explaining that Chupacabra has only been around for 20 years. It appeared in 1995. And the guy's like, it's like, oh, you're totally wrong. I know, because I grew up in Texas, and you know, I remember hearing about it and all this. And I said, well, you know, you may be right. I mean, where's your evidence? Do you have any, you know, something written, account, whatever else? I'm willing to look at your evidence. And he's like, well, no, actually, the real reason that I doubt is, you know, I saw this TV show last month, and it said something different. Hmm. I was like, I'm sorry, excuse me? I spent 5 years researching this topic. I had it published at the University of New Mexico Press. It's been peer-reviewed. I have all my references, all my interviews. It's all there. I wrote a book on this, a 270-page book. And I'm wrong because you saw a TV show that said something different? Yeah. Really? This is wow. And, you know, it's like, it just, oh yeah, because people believe what they see on TV, right?
Yeah.
It was just astonishing to me. And again, I don't mind if someone thinks I'm wrong or I'm full of shit. That's fine. I respect that, but give me the courtesy and respect of saying, why is it wrong? What is your evidence? Why do you think that? Not just like, well, that's not what I want to believe. Well, yeah. Okay. Fine.
Well, that's a big problem with the American culture, is that we tend to believe what we see on TV, regardless of the quality of the TV program that we're actually watching.
Exactly.
And I understand that the Discovery Channel recently came out and said they're not going to play any more of this crap that they've been playing. Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. That's been sort of a minor sore point for me for several years now. As I mentioned, I write for Discovery News, which is a branch of the Discovery Network, which also includes the Discovery Channel. And I have nothing to do with the TV shows. The network and TV is a totally separate entity, but nonetheless, they're both branded Discovery. And so I on occasion have had to sort of sit through and apologize for some of the really horrible programming, this really mystery mongering crap. There was the famous, you know, Mermaids the Body Found was one of them. There was another one on the a Russian Yeti that supposedly was eating people in the 1950s. And so the way that I handled that was, on more than one occasion, I've written critical pieces about the Discovery Channel program. And to their credit, my editors at the Discovery News have run it. Even though I'm essentially debunking the and bringing science and skepticism to the topic. Now, I don't know whether they got any crap from the network, but my position is, look, you know, you're paying me to write and give a skeptical science-based perspective on this. The fact that you know that a branch of Discovery put this out there, that's not going to stop me from writing. You can choose to run it or not, but I'm going to write about this. And to their credit, they've pretty much let me do that. But yes, I did see the recent news where the new head of the network has promised no more sort of pseudo documentaries We'll see what happens. I welcome it. I've actually had to waste a lot of my time debunking those pseudo documentaries. But yeah, any time that a network vows to decrease the amount of misinformation, it's certainly a good thing.
Are they related to the History Channel? And when I say history, I mean history in quotes.
I don't know, is the short answer. I'm not, they might be, I don't really know how the sort of networks and umbrella corporations work. Okay.
Because I know the History Channel has been having that same issue with the quality of their content and the historical accuracy of the content they've been showing. And of course that's a problem because people tend to trust the Discovery Channel and the History Channel. I mean, these are what maybe once were, or I'm not sure exactly why scientific facts and accuracy are associated with these two channels, but they just are, and it's unfortunate because it's not. Let me put it this way: the History Channel is to history as Fox News is to news.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, to be honest, the network that I personally give most credibility to is the National Geographic Channel. Hmm. They've partly because I've done a couple of series for them. I did a series called Is It Real? That ran, I think it was on about a dozen episodes, and I was on six or seven of them, I think. And Is It Real? It's available on Netflix and DVD if anyone wants to check it out. It's a really good science-based perspective on it. I'm included in there. Other investigators that I know and respect are included there as well. And it's a good example of a rebuttal to the skeptical argument that I often hear about, well, you know, these things are, the skeptics are always, you know, making things boring and debunking everything. And I disagree with that because, you know, to my mind, these are fascinating subjects, you know, miracles, you know, near-death experience, chupacabras, ghosts, psychics. These are not boring. These are fascinating things. And just because I and others bring science to it and can explain it, that doesn't, to my mind, that doesn't take away from the magic of it. That doesn't take away from, it makes it even more interesting because then the question is, well, if these things aren't really there, lake monsters, whatever else, then what are people mistaking for them or psychic experiences? And so I think that the Israel program is a good example of how to do good skeptical science-based content and still make it interesting and sexy.
All right. Well, Benjamin, what keeps you busy these days and where can people find out more information about you?
Oh, billions and billions of things. I had a book come out about 2 months ago called Mysterious New Mexico. The subtitle is Miracles, Magic, and Monsters in the Land of Enchantment. And it's basically a collection of a dozen investigations here in my home state of New Mexico. I had done investigations, of course, all around the world of various weird things. And when I went to talk to UNM Press that published my Chupacabra book, they're like, well, what else do you have on tap? I said, well, you know, I've done these investigations. I said, well, how about something in your home state? I'm like, all right, there's weird things around here. I see them every time I step out the door. So it's a collection of investigations of ghosts. There's a UFO case. There's all sorts of interesting monsters and things like that. So that's Mysterious New Mexico. It's been out for a couple months and it's gotten really good reviews, and I'm still doing some press for that. I just finished a book on bad clowns, of all things. I sort of switched topics, and I just turned it into the publisher about a week ago, and it'll probably won't be out for about 6 or 7 months. It'll have to go through peer review and editing and indexing, but it'll be out later this year, and it's sort of a history on what it says, bad clowns, everything from I go to the early history of like the Harlequin, the Punch and Judy shows, to more contemporary bad clowns from Stephen King's It to Pennywise, Obnoxio the Clown, for those who remember Crazy Magazine.
Well, a clarification here, Ben, when you say bad clown, you just don't mean clown that's not funny.
No, I mean clowns that are... Well, see, this is the thing, is that when I was trying to come up with a title, is that because some people said, well, how about evil clowns? And I said, no, because not all bad clowns are evil. Evil clowns are a subset of bad clowns, but they're not the entirety. And so, yes, I'm not just talking about clowns that are bad at their job, because frankly, we see people are bad at their job all the time, right?
Of course.
So no, we're talking about clowns that are maladjusted, obnoxious. Some of them are killers. Some of them are just mean. Some of them, just everything from Krusty the Clown, the Joker, of course. Interestingly, last year, was a bang up year for scary stalking clowns. There were clowns in Staten Island and before that Northampton, England, and also there were clown scares in France and also in Bakersfield, California, where people were dressing up as clowns and sort of standing outside late at night, scaring the people as they walked by. So I have some of that. It'll be an interesting book.
That sounds great. All right, and your website?
I am at BenjaminRadford.com. I'm also on Facebook, Ben Radford. I'm here, I'm there, I'm everywhere. I do blogs for the Center for Inquiry. I do articles for Discovery News and occasionally LiveScience.com. I'm on Twitter. You know, I have the media presence, as they say.
All right. And that's how I found you.
There you go.
Well, thanks so much for being on, Ben. This was a great conversation, and I really would love to talk to you so much longer. I had a whole list here of alien abductions and UFOs and favorite stories that I wanted to hear, but maybe we'll have to bring you on again to finish all that.
I'll come back again. We'll do it. It'll be fun.
All right. Thanks a lot for being on. I appreciate it.
Sure.
All right. That was Benjamin Radford, and we were talking about scientific paranormal investigation, how to solve unexplained mysteries. Unfortunately, I had to cut about 15 minutes out of this interview. What I cut out mostly was the story I told him about something that happened to me in college that could be seen as paranormal or supernatural, and I kind of brought him in as a virtual investigator, and we went back and forth and talked about some of the issues. It was interesting, but it went on kind of long, so I had to cut that whole part out. Maybe I'll tell that story some other time, and we can go through it, and we could find out why what may be seen as a really weird and strange and perhaps paranormal story might actually be very natural and not very strange. Well, that wraps it up for this week. Love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thanks a lot, folks. See you next time on the Humanist Hour.